Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. So it has been a while, and I'm glad to be back with the Phillips family. Specifically, we're still on Bijou, although we're going to make the transition in this episode, basically, between Bijou and her dad. But going back to 2015, remember Going Clear came out. Alex Gibney. And it was on HBO, but before it was HBO, it was at the Sundance Film Festival. And Danny Masterson happened to be there at the same time it was at Sundance. So, of course, people wanted to interview him. And they asked him about Going Clear. And he said, I heard about that documentary. The documentary where they interviewed 8 people who hate Scientology. Should be pretty interesting. I wonder if Sundance would allow a documentary of like 8 people who hate Judaism. But, you know, my religion's fair game, I guess, because it's new. No, it's because it's a horrible thing. And he said that Scientology gave him all his solid relationships, I guess, including serial sexually assaulting, raping people. He said, I didn't really notice anything different in terms of my upbringing until I was in junior high school. Maybe a little bit before that. I grew up in New York and it was just sort of like everyone hated their parents and were always cheating and lying. And I was able just to be friends with my parents. A lot of people have that in their life, but I noticed that all my friends who were Scientologists, kids I had grown up with, we all sort of had the same thing, easy communication. It wasn't this whole us versus them thing. And he said he started coursework when he was 8 or 9 years old, and then when he was 15, old enough to read Dianetics, he signed it. It was effing awesome. And talked about psychiatry and Scientology. He said, you'll not find a Scientologist who does not effing hate psychiatrists because their solution for mental and spiritual problem is drugs. Correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't you administering drugs to all of these women that you raped? So let's talk about putting a Band-Aid on something that's just going to get worse and worse and worse. Scientology handles those things, those mental problems that people have. It gets rid of them. This is not exactly the greatest quote from somebody who obviously has a lot of mental problems, and Scientology couldn't get rid of them. It enabled them. But he said it gets rid of them by that person doing it for themselves. No, it gets rid of them because Scientology, again, enabled. He wouldn't have got away with all this stuff, but they made everybody become a Scientologist. They threatened all of these people. They made them sign NDAs. They said that you couldn't sue. But he said that's the solution. Not effing Prozac and whatever the pill that makes the kid then walk into a school and kill other kids. And he said that Scientology is accepted. I haven't had a conversation like this about my philosophy, I don't think, ever. But I love doing it, have no problem doing it. I work, I have a family, and I'm a spiritual being. And you rape people. Who likes to understand why things happen in the world and want to learn more so that I can have them not affect me adversely. So if that's weird, then, well, you can go F yourself. And he knew all of these things were there. I mean, it's 2015. But he thought Scientology, and so of course he's going to be really kind to Scientology because they're the ones who are protecting him at this point. Here's a blind. September 11th, 2015. The powers that be over at that always looming cult are coming up with a response because one of their higher profile celebrity members who's married to a celebrity is on the Ashley Madison list. Danny Masterson. June 24th, 2016, just because this B-list actor with A-minus list name recognition and A-list face recognition most recently seen in an almost television show has an open marriage, doesn't mean his wife appreciates him bringing home an STD. Things are super rocky and the open part of the marriage is out the window. Danny Masterson. And then in February of 2017, Bijou was rushed to the hospital. She got a blood infection, needed a kidney transplant. Rushed to the hospital in Santa Barbara. And Bijou had been feeling ill, had a fever that spiked. And we found out that she needed a kidney transplant. And apparently she'd been suffering from kidney disease for several years. She had been on the kidney transplant list, found a donor. And Danny about that said, look, Bijou was born with small kidneys and has been quietly dealing with kidney disease for the last 5 years, including being on the transplant list. In an effort to heal her body, she's led a stress-free life with a vegan diet, which eventually wasn't enough. And she's been privately having weekly dialysis. My lady has been slowly dying for the past 7 years of an incurable kidney disease. She was given the gift of an encore by a tall angel. Our daughter will have a mother. We do not take lightly how incredibly fortunate we are. 100% successful transplant. Now the real work begins for her to silence any chance of rejection. Our deepest gratitude to be a perfect transplant team and a life owed to a tall drink of water. And he posted the donor's photo. But in December 2017, there was an event. Neither one was wearing a wedding ring. November 13, 2022. I'm reminded this weekend of what the perv director who makes very questionable movies once said long ago about the wife of the actor on trial. The only reason she was ever cast in anything is because of the number of people she slept with as a teen who felt like they owed her a favor. The perv director will have you believe he was immune to her charms. If she was over 18 at the time, then maybe. And that's Larry Clark, Bijou Phillips, and Danny Masterson. September 8th, 2023. Don't forget that the wife of the rapist was separated from him and living hundreds of miles away from him. Then when he got arrested, they made her come back to him. That's Bijou and Danny. September 13th, 2023. The wife of the actor slash serial rapist is already back at the home where she lived until the actor was arrested and made her move back in with him. I'm sure the actor's brother staying with her for moral support. And that's Bijou and Danny Masterson and Jordan Masterson. And then I revealed it, I think, on the 20th. And on the 19th, she had filed for divorce. September 20th, 2023. If the divorce of the barely there celebrity and the actor continues, I wouldn't be shocked if we get a little paternity surprise. Bijou and Danny. Now, to get to John Phillips, kind of got to get from Bijou to John. And I think the best way is to talk about one of the more interesting people. And that's Genevieve Waite, who is the mom of Bijou. She was born Genevieve Wright. Actually, Genevieve Waite, sorry, in South Africa. And she grew up in Johannesburg, and she later changed the spelling of her name. So, Waite still, but not W-E-I-G-H-T. And her father worked as an engineer, and her mom assisted in anti-apartheid. But Genevieve was really close to this chaos, the violence and the unrest. So she went to England in 1967 at the age of 19. And she won a modeling contest. Everybody kind of called her the South African Twiggy. Within 2 days of her arrival in London, 2 days, she met Vidal Sassoon, asked her to model for him within 2 days. Didn't have to wait long for her break. And then British film director Michael Sarn cast her as the lead in his feature film, Joanna. If you've never seen it, it's kind of like the female version of Alfie. Basically a promiscuous, flighty art student looking for love in London in the 60s. And the movie premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in 1968. It caused a scandal because it had an interracial love affair between Waite and a co-star, Calvin Lockhart, and in her home country, her family was subject to death threats. And Joanna is this, if you've never seen it, you should. And basically, it's got to be one of the only movies that I can think of off the top of my head where the director actually had a number one song, like a single, called Come Outside. It is a it's a 1960s kind of song. It went to number one, at least in the UK. And this, you know, Michael Sarn guy, he dated Brigitte Bardot. He was a hugely popular photographer. And he directed Joanna. If you've never seen it, it makes London look absolutely gorgeous. There's plenty of sex. It is believable. And he, Sarn, remembers that he was standing on a corner of Soho Square in 1967 with another director who was also the Beatles photographer, Bob Freeman. And Bob wanted to make a film called The Touchables about models kidnapping a pop singer. Well, they were standing at this intersection with Richard Zanuck. And he goes, you know, The Sound of Music just made me $90 million. So I'll give you guys each $1 million. And Michael Sarn's like, $1 million? I was 26 years old and now I'm a millionaire. But his resume at this point, it had the number one song, but a bunch of, you know, singles that flopped. He had a degree in Russian. He had done some fashion photography, and he'd even been an actor. And he started directing, it was a travelogue, and it was called The Road to Saint-Tropez. And he did it in 1966. But his companion on the trip was his girlfriend, named Joanne. And he said Joanne had a lovely figure, but quite an anonymous face. She could just put lipstick on and you wouldn't recognize her. But she was totally into fashion. Wore Chanel and Gucci, and looked like she belonged everywhere. I wasn't her only boyfriend, but I wasn't jealous. And he said from her pillow talk, he got the whole story for Joanna, went away and wrote it in 2 weeks. And he wanted to make what he called the London Dolce Vita. Pregnancies, abortions, beatings. And Sarnad wanted his girlfriend to be cast, but that was vetoed by Michael Laughlin. And Laughlin had been introduced to Genevieve. And this, again, was right after she came from South Africa. And everybody said, you know, Genevieve had these big, deep circles in her eyes. She couldn't act, but she had a figure like Twiggy. And Sarn stayed friends with Waite until she died and says she was perfect for the role. She wasn't a glamour puss. He said her blankness in a kind of way reflected Joanne. She's highly intelligent, but has that dopiness down. She plays on it. And Michael Laughlin, great career. He died of COVID back in 2021. But he did Tulane Blacktop, Town and Country. And he had played basketball at Stanford. But he, after Stanford, he says, you know what? I'm going to go to London. And he became a film producer there. And he did The Whispers, and then he did Joanna. And he even married Leslie Caron, who, still alive, amazing career. But Laughlin produced Tulane Blacktop. It's the one that stars James Taylor. In 2012, the Library of Congress selected it for preservation. But he had a nice career. He did Mesmerized with Jodie Foster and John Lithgow. He did Strange Invaders. He wrote Town and Country. So he had a nice little career. And Sarn told the producers, he goes like this. He goes, Roman Polanski is going to be the head of the jury for the 68 Cannes Film Festival. And I'm friends with him. And so he told 20th Century Fox to enter Joanna. Because he said, Roman will give me a prize. Best newcomer, best script. And Fox was like, really? He can't do that. But Sarn says, you know, they were very naive. You know, you can convince anybody of anything like on that. But he said it was the worst thing that could have happened. Because the 1968 Cannes Festival was a disaster. Sarn had a Rolls Royce and was pelted with eggs by demonstrators. Genevieve was trapped in her hotel. The festival had to be abandoned. There was just too many protesters. But it did well in America. And Sarn moved to Hollywood. Became a director. And he's the one who introduced Genevieve Waite to John Phillips, who he called utterly sordid. And because Joanna did well, Genevieve got a contract with 20th Century Fox, and she moved to New York. And when she was in New York, she lived in the Chelsea Hotel, and she was briefly married to poet Matthew Reich. You guys might know him by a different name, Crazy Matty. And Crazy Matty was one of the Warhol set. And, you know, I had always thought that Valerie Solanas was the only one who had ever tried to kill Andy Warhol. Well, apparently, Crazy Matty did too. And basically, Matty was called Crazy Matty by Warhol. And Matty would trail him and watch his window by night. And basically, everybody said that he tried to kill him once. I don't know. I mean, that was in the book that was done by Pat Hackett. And he talks about that a little bit. But he also talks, I mean, if you guys have never read the Andy Warhol Diaries, you obviously have to read it. I'm sure most of you have read it. But I mean, this is like 800 pages of a lot of gossip. And, you know, he tells a story about like Liza Minnelli stuffing cocaine up her nose, pausing only long enough to like whip out her private parts at a conquest. Talks about Christopher Walken and Mickey Rourke making out. Talks about Margaret Trudeau and how, you know, she enjoyed quite a bit of cocaine and stuff. It's a crazy book. But Crazy Maddie's in it. And this is the only time that I've ever heard of anybody other than Valerie Solanas possibly wanting, you know, to kill Andy Warhol. But it's just, it's crazy to me that Genevieve Waite used to be married to Crazy Maddie. Like, that was her first husband. And I think that Valerie Solanas is actually the, you know, it's kind of the epitome of the whole everybody will be famous for 15 minutes. Now, everybody always says that Andy said it, but Andy probably didn't say it. But Valerie Solanas kind of lived it. Because you're back in 1968. Andy Warhol, he's at the top, right? He is where he is. And then in June of 1968, Valerie Solanas went into Andy's office, pulled out a gun, and shot him. And Andy kind of barely, well, he did barely survive the shooting. And it probably did lead to his death a couple of decades later. And Solanas, very troubled person. Grew up in New Jersey. She was supposedly, you know, sexually abused by her father. Her parents had got divorced when she was four. But even though her dad supposedly, you know, had sex with her, sexually assaulted her, she had a correspondence with him for most of her life. But the fact that, and Genevieve was all involved in this, and Andy Warhol, and she knew Solanas. And she knew about that. And the fact that John Phillips then, you know, had sex with Mackenzie Phillips. And, you know, in the last episode, I talked about Danny Masterson watching Bijou having sex scenes with his brother, just like kind of all intertwines. And this Valerie Solanas, she was, you know, a normal child, but in middle school, apparently she started skipping class. She assaulted a teacher. By 15, she'd given birth to two children. One, Linda, was raised as her sister. A son, David, she placed for adoption and had no contact with him ever. And she went to the University of Maryland, studied psychology, tried to get a master's degree in psychology, but dropped out. And then for the next 10 years, she put her ideas to paper. And she would move a lot because she was always getting evicted. And in 1966, she had a short story that was published. It was called A Young Girl's Primer. And it was in Cavalier, which was kind of like Playboy. But they published like Stephen King and Ray Bradbury. But her short story was about a woman who sells sex and conversation for the freedom to be creative. And then the next year was what she became famous for, other than Andy Warhol's attempted killing, and it was Scum. That's what she wrote. And she wanted a play. And the Scum is Society for Cutting Up Men. And if you think about when she wrote it, and as soon as the first time I ever heard about Society for Cutting Up Men, I was like, well, that sounds like World According to Garp. And basically, John Irving has said that, yeah, you know, it influenced him. And he wanted to have a character and a like a cult kind of thing that was like the Society for Cutting Up Men. And basically, you know, she did that. And this Scum manifesto involved like overturning capitalism, getting rid of everything, but especially getting rid of men. She wanted men to be eliminated from the population. And everybody's like, oh, she's kidding. But she would always say, no, I'm not kidding. But she struggled with her mental health. And she stands out. She's completely different than women that you would normally see in the 50s and the 60s. She comes to New York City in 1962. And New York was where she was able to be herself. She came out as a lesbian. She can be whatever she wants. And she moved to the Chelsea Hotel, the same place that Genevieve Waite lived. And the Chelsea Hotel, always artists and writers and people who didn't quite fit. And she did odd jobs. She was a sex worker, but she obsessed over Scum. She would write it and revise it, and she would start selling it. And she self-published it, sold mimeographed copies to men for $2.50, but women could have it for $1. And when she was living at the Chelsea, she met and signed the rights to Scum over to a publisher. And that publisher, it was Olympia Press. And they're the ones who did Naked Lunch, The Story of O, Lolita. And so she signs a contract with this publisher. But she starts getting paranoid. And she misinterpreted the document and contract and feared that she had signed away the rights to her future and her writings as well. But it was at this time that she met Andy Warhol. And she wanted him to produce her play, Up Your Ass. And she gave Andy one of her only copies of the play. And Andy laughed and, you know, threw it away, basically. It was extremely explicit. But Valerie wouldn't be deterred. She continued to follow up with Warhol about the play, and he started feeling bad, so he gave her money and paid her $25 to act in his experimental film, I, a Man. But her paranoia is getting out of hand. And when Andy told her, hey, I'll give you a job as a typist at the factory, because of how well-typed her play was, she took the gesture to mean he was trying to steal her property. So she developed this theory that this publisher and Warhol were both conspiring to steal her work. But they didn't even know each other. On June 3rd, 1968, Solana showed up at the publisher's office, and the head of the company wasn't there. But she told his secretary that she was planning to kill her boss, and then she went to Union Square, waited for Andy outside his office. And he comes in the afternoon, sees Valerie, and they ride the elevator together up to his office. It's a bunch of people already there. And those people start talking to Valerie, and then she reaches for a gun, and she pulls it out, and she just starts shooting it. And she eventually strikes Warhol, hitting him with a bullet that ripped through a lot of his organs. Falls to the ground. He smashes into a desk. He smashes his head. And eventually she comes right up, presses the gun against his side, just under his armpit, and shoots again. A bunch of more organs destroyed. She also shot a London art critic. She aimed at Fred Hughes, Andy's business manager. And then all of a sudden the elevator's open. And she like ran out. Rides down the elevator. And then 3 hours after the shooting, she surrendered to the NYPD. She told a traffic cop that Warhol had too much control over her life. Well, of course, the New York media is going to run with this. And the New York Daily News put her on the front page with the headline, Actress Shoots Warhol. And she demanded a retraction because she told the paper, I'm a writer, not an actress. And so, of course, the New York Daily News, they issued the retraction, changed the headline. This was like a month before 911 happened in New York. So basically, it took forever for ambulances to get there, and Andy had to wait 20 minutes for an ambulance. But he had a ruptured stomach, liver, spleen, and lungs. He was pronounced clinically dead, but doctors massaged his heart. He was operated on for 5 hours by Dr. Giuseppe Rossi, an Italian immigrant. And Dad had no idea that he was operating on Andy Warhol. But the son, you know, talks about it a lot because the dad would talk about it after his doctor. And Andy spent 2 months in the hospital. And his injuries were so severe that he had to wear a surgical corset for the rest of his life. And then the crazy thing is 2 days after Andy was shot, Robert Kennedy was shot and killed by Sirhan Sirhan. And Andy's like in the hospital. And he's loopy from all the medication and the surgeries and everything like that. And he hears that Robert Kennedy had been killed, who was a friend of his, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., very good friends with Andy Warhol and stuff, and friends with Genevieve Waite. But Warhol just couldn't wrap his head around it. He thought that he was hallucinating. But he never forgot what Dr. Rossi had done for him. And Dr. Rossi's son has talked about it. He said, the presence Andy Warhol had in our lives was a very dutiful orchid, sent pretty much every holiday season with a thank you note. So we always got an orchid from Andy Warhol around Christmas time. Said to Dr. Rossi, thanks so much. And Warhol also gifted the Rossis with a bunch of the paintings from the Campbell soup cans. And the parents didn't ever display them. They just kept them under the bed because there was no room in the apartment. But they auctioned the paintings in 2017 for, obviously, many millions of dollars. But Andy Warhol chose not to press charges against Solanas because he said, look, she was acting in her nature and that's who she was. And Solanas appears before a judge. And she said, what I did to Warhol was a moral act and I consider it immoral that I missed. I should have done target practice. And she was charged with attempted murder, assault, illegal possession of a gun. But because she got this notoriety, the publisher, Olympia Press, published the Scum Manifesto because she got her 15 minutes. The manifesto wouldn't have been published if she didn't have that story. That's your 15 minutes. She won a trial in 1969, represented herself, pleaded guilty to reckless assault, She got 3 years in prison with 1 year of time served. And then when she's in prison, she's writing Andy Warhol a bunch of letters. She'd start them off like, "Dear Toad." And the feminist movement couldn't really decide. They're like, okay, well, we don't condone violence, but, you know, it's a symbol of women being pushed to the edge. When she was released from prison in 1971, stalked Andy Warhol, and Andy was frightened that she was out of jail. He didn't get killed, but it changed his life because he became nervous and afraid from that day forward. He was always afraid it could happen again. And if he ever saw anybody that reminded him even vaguely of Valerie, he was scared. But he had to go out, right? He depended on going out. He needed to meet people. He needed to go to nightclubs. He needed to go to restaurants. When Solanas was out of prison, she found herself homeless. She had a bunch of breakdowns. She became consumed with an idea that her uterus had a uterine transmitter that was communicating messages to the mob. So she tried to dig the transmitter out of her body with a fork. She got arrested a couple more times for stalking Andy, went back to prison, and then finally she moved out to San Francisco. She started doing drugs, started getting back into sex work. And then she found out that Andy Warhol died from a former factory person, Ultraviolet. And when Ultraviolet told Valerie Solanas that Andy Warhol died, she goes, "Oh, he died? Yeah. Let me ask you some questions about the copyright for the Scum Manifesto." And if you ever saw I Shot Andy Warhol, she's played by Lily Taylor, who we've talked about in other episodes. And Lena Dunham played Solanas in an episode of American Horror Story Cult. And then they found the script that she had given Andy Warhol for her play. It was found by the Andy Warhol Museum. So they do have the one of the only copies of Up Your Ass. But Genevieve was there. She's part of this whole thing around Warhol's factory. She served as a muse to photographer Richard Avedon, shot her for Vogue. And like I said, one night in the summer of 1969, Sarn, the director of Joanna, introduced her to Phillips, who had just recently separated from Michelle. And John Phillips and Genevieve, they took mescaline together on a beach in Malibu and were inseparable from then on. And they got married in 1972. After the birth of their son, Tamerlane. It was a ceremony that was done by a one-legged Buddhist monk at the Golden Palace restaurant in L.A. Mick Jagger was there, Bianca was there, Cass Elliot was there, Joni Mitchell, Jack Nicholson, Donald Sutherland. Friends of theirs who couldn't make it was Jerry Brown, Princess Margaret of Britain, RFK Jr., John Paul Getty Jr., the dad of Baltazar. And Margaret Trudeau, and I told you about it. She did the coke and stuff with Andy all the time. It's crazy. And there's this party, picture of this party. It was in London, July 23rd, 1979. And it was a Halston party at the Savoy. And there's Liza Minnelli in the photo, Andy Warhol, Catherine Guinness, who we've talked about before, Richard Weissman, Martha Graham, Bianca Jagger, Steve Rubell, Studio 54, Princess Margaret, Roddy Llewellyn, Liza Minnelli. I mean, they're just all there in this photo. It's one of the best photos of the time, like of the 70s, and that whole Studio 54 vibe, even though it was taken in London. But John Phillips is crazy about Genevieve and did a whole album, Romances on the Rise, that he produced for her, a kind of updated 1940s big band and swing music. And featured album art shot by Avedon of Genevieve. And they also conceived and co-wrote Space, which was kind of like this pre-Star Wars space opera set to music. And it was going to be Michael Butler's follow-up to Hair. And Genevieve, you know, acted opposite Elliot Gould and Paul Prentice in the sex comedy Move. It's quite the movie poster, the one sheet for that. All three of them are naked on it. And then she was supposed to play David Bowie's girlfriend in The Man Who Fell to Earth. Now, that was later played by Candy Clark. And the reason that she didn't get to play it, because John Phillips got into a fist fight with director Nick Rogue at a Manhattan cabaret. And it is quite the story. Nick was a guy who got into fights with everybody. But because she couldn't be in, she had to settle for a song in the film soundtrack. And the soundtrack is one of the original, not conspiracy theories, but like urban legends. And everybody always assumed that the soundtrack of The Man Who Fell to Earth was that David Bowie had recorded a soundtrack and that it sits in some kind of vault somewhere waiting for it to see the light of day. One problem, though. Doesn't actually exist. The music that appears in the film was written and produced by John Phillips. Even though he and Nick had gotten into this huge fight that cost Genevieve the role. Or did it? Originally, David Bowie was signed to star in and to compose the soundtrack for the movie. He was going to record the music once the shooting had completed. It was going to be the follow-up to his album Young Americans. But he started working instead on Station to Station, and he's, you know, doing a ton of cocaine at this time. And after 3 months, he'd done like 5 or 6 tracks. It was like country rock, instrumentals. He'd done them like on African thumb pianos and stuff. It was totally crazy. But there was this British arranger who had worked on the demos with Bowie. And they composed the music and they did it, you know, along to a videotape of the film. But none of it was actually synced to the picture. So it was unusable. So the director, Nick Rogue, he gets it. And he says, "What is this?" So he doesn't have a soundtrack. And we're like weeks away from the planned premiere in March of 1976. So he gets on his knees and apologizes to John Phillips. And basically, you know, okay, you know, I'm sorry for what happened before. And what did happen actually was John Phillips and Genevieve were doing like this musical comedy act at this cabaret club in Greenwich Village. And, you know, Nick offers Genevieve the role of Mary Lou in The Man Who Fell to Earth. And says he told John he wanted me to do it. But John Phillips had other ideas because he had done Space and was about to go into production. And he told Nick, he goes, "Genevieve's going to be working on the Broadway show." And then he and Nick were so drunk that they had this terrible fight. They knocked over tables and stuff. But Nick got into a lot of fights. The guy who edited The Man Who Fell to Earth said, "Everybody who knows Nick at one point or another has got into rolling around on the floor fight with him." If John Phillips had not had a fight with him, I'd say, "Oh, really?" So Nick was actually going out with Candy Clark, so that's another reason, probably got replaced. But Nick shows John Phillips a cut of the film on like a small portable TV. John Phillips, you know, loved the movie, but he didn't know why Nick was asking him to work on the soundtrack because David Bowie was the obvious choice. But John Phillips decided to do the job. So he goes to London, 1976, has to do a score from scratch, has like 3 or 4 weeks. John Phillips goes, "Oh, I need somebody who can really play." So he gets Mick Taylor, former guitarist for the Rolling Stones, who he considered the best guitar player in the world. And John Phillips has rented a house in Chelsea, and they're working and they're working. And then one day, Keith Richards walks in, and there's Mick Taylor sitting there. Keith Richards lets out a scream, and they both froze because they hadn't seen each other since Taylor had walked out on the Rolling Stones like a year earlier. John Phillips said it was a little testy. Kind of like, he said that they were like dogs circling. But Keith broke the ice, grabbed a guitar, started playing. And John Phillips said, "We just played old country songs. And those would become the basis for the music that Phillips recorded for the film." So it had a lot of originals, but it had a bunch of covers too. And a lot of the music was very improvised. It had all this intense pressure to produce the music in a matter of weeks. But John Phillips, you know, he's going to be John Phillips. You know, a lot of drugs, a lot of sex. And after one session, he arrives back home around 2 o'clock in the morning. Nobody was there. So he walks over to Mick Jagger's house, looking for his wife, Genevieve. But instead, he finds Bianca. And Liza Minnelli's younger sister's there, Lorna Luft. But Genevieve wasn't there. Mick wasn't there. So they all sat around, drank wine, and got wasted. John Phillips said, "You know, I was playing the guitar, singing some songs and stuff." Lorna leaves, and then John and Bianca, who had enjoyed a brief affair in 1970 before she met and married Mick, ended up in bed together. At some point about dawn, they both fall asleep. Well, the recording session the next morning, John Phillips is a no-show. The musicians are there. The engineers are there. They're just waiting. Someone, you know, calls over to his rental house, find out where he is, and Genevieve takes the call. So she goes over to Mick Jagger's house, figuring he might be there, talks the help into letting her in, and was told he was in the bedroom with Bianca. And John Phillips said, you know, so we're awakened around 10:30 a.m. There was Genevieve saying, I know you're in there, you two. And he's like, oh, my God, here I am in Mick's bed with Mick's wife. My wife's outside banging on the door. There were Nicaraguan maids running around screaming in Spanish. Genevieve storms in the door, takes a punch at Bianca. I sort of hold Genevieve back, take her out. She just ran down the street, but I had to go to work. And the final session for The Score was 2 weeks before the film's world premiere. John Phillips is mixing the tracks so they could be laid into the edit. And then all of a sudden, he started becoming a little crazy because he could hear clicks and noises on the tape, but the engineer's like, there's nothing there. He wants to do everything over. And by the fourth or fifth day, things were pretty tense between John Phillips and the engineer. Then something snapped. John Phillips lost it. He walked out of the session. The engineer walks out. And the next morning, the engineer has been replaced. And the engineer basically said that John Phillips had been, at the end of every take, going to the bathroom and just snorting coke. He was doing unbelievable amounts of coke, so much that he was having auditory hallucinations. And the director, Nick, came to the studio, had a serious discussion with John Phillips about his behavior, said, hey, stop. Let's get it finished tonight. And over the next couple days, the music just came flying out of the studio. And Nick said he was really happy with the music that John Phillips produced for the film. But Genevieve didn't get to be in the movie. She had to be in space. It was retitled Man on the Moon. It was produced on Broadway by Warhol. But it was directed by Paul Morrissey, like this Warhol acolyte, who directed this Broadway play in the matter of like his underground films. Critics hated it. Closed 5 days after it opened. And they really never got over the failure of that musical at all. By 1976, they're living in an apartment in London with Keith Richards and Anita Pallenberg. They're both addicted to cocaine and heroin. John Phillips is working on his second solo album. And like I said, I'm going to go into more detail about this in the next episode when we get to John Phillips, but this is just kind of what Genevieve was going through. But by like 1980, the Phillipses both went to rehab. That's when Bijou was born. And then there was John Phillips' bust in 1980 for drug trafficking. And, I mean, it is a crazy, crazy life that Genevieve had. She had this great singing voice. And it was kind of described as like Betty Boop crossed with Billie Holiday. And she did have some comic skills, kind of like a Marilyn Monroe dizziness. I know they called it dopiness, but I think it's more of a dizziness kind of thing. But she was extremely smart. She co-wrote some of, you know, John Phillips' songs. And there was one song, Let It Bleed, Genevieve. And that was basically Genevieve wanted to be reborn as a man. But specifically, she wanted to be reborn as Mick Jagger. And I do wonder if she and Mick Jagger, when John was hooking up with Bianca, if the reason Genevieve and Mick hadn't been around is because Genevieve and Mick were hooking up. But that song was on John Phillips' 1970 solo album, John the Wolf King of L.A. And he had seen a poem written by Genevieve, and that was reprinted on the record sleeve. And they got divorced in 1988. But, I mean, they have all these songs about everything. There's Tamerlane, who we need to talk to. I guess we should do Tamerlane maybe before we do John Phillips, or combine the two because they kind of go together. Genevieve, wait, a great, interesting life. And I do wonder what she thought of maybe of like Danny Masterson and stuff. And what she thought about Scientology. Whether or not, you know, what she thought about Bijou and stuff. I mean, because obviously for much of Bijou's upbringing, especially, you know, Bijou when she was 13 had to go to New York and stuff. And now you kind of get the feeling why. You get the feeling, you understand why Bijou had to go to foster care when she was three, because she's got Genevieve and John as her parents. But it's interesting how all of these things tie in together. You know, and I don't think people necessarily think of Genevieve as being part of, you know, Andy Warhol in the factory. But she was married to Crazy Maddie. So in the next episode, we will get to John Phillips. We will get to Tamerlane. And we will get to so much more. All right, you guys, that's it for today. I will talk to you later.